So great to be back here. I was saying to Jonathan earlier today, how long has it been since we've been at Lisvain Baptist? Just check. Yeah, we worked out 6 years and 4 months. Yeah. And I can't believe I'm back here actually chatting to you like this. What's God been doing? He's been doing some stuff, isn't he? Wow. Yeah, so now I'm a prison chaplain. Yeah, I didn't see that coming. Did any of you see that coming? No. Okay, well, I've been a prison chaplain for about 18 months. Before that, I did a bit of hospital chaplaincy, but it was as a volunteer. And unfortunately, that didn't really materialise into something, you know, full time. I've had probably about 10 jobs since I've seen you last. I've had so many jobs, honestly. One going from one to the other, never happy. And now finally, I'm in the prison and I don't know how to even say this to you. It's like I'm home. And that's really bad, isn't it? You know? But it is. It just feels so right. It's been brilliant. So I work in 2 different prisons. Not initially. I'm contracted to a prison called Eastwood Park, which is in Gloucestershire. It's got about 450 female prisoners staying there. And now I'm working 2 different prisons. So the other prison is a Cat D men's prison. And that's got a whole mix of offences. But for me to explain a little bit more, I have to kind of explain to you the categories of prisons. So you've got different categories of prisons, A to D. So a Cat A prison is a super secure one where the prisoners aren't allowed out of their cells that often. They have to be escorted everywhere. It might be that there need to be 2 officers present to unlock them. And it usually, for high security, it might be that person might be in for, say, terrorism or perhaps murder, although any of the Cat A to Ds can have people who have committed the crime of murder. So it doesn't mean that all the serious crimes are Cat A. It just means that there's perhaps more risk to the public. So people need to go to Cat A. So in the women's estate in which I work, there's only about 12 prisons in the country for women compared to, say, 120 prisons for men. There's no women prisons in Wales, but there is, the nearest one is Eastwood Park, which is just over the Severn Bridge. Go on to the M5 and it's the first turning off the M5. So it's relatively close. Now, the difference between, say, a women's prison and a men's prison is they're all chucked into one prison. So you've got people who have maybe committed an offence of robbery you might have a woman who's, committed the offence of murder. So they don't have this kind of Cat A, Cat B, Cat C. They just have open or closed. So I work in a closed prison. However, there's one area of the prison that's classed as open, which means that they can come out of their cell a bit longer. There's less restrictions on their movements. And sometimes if they've been super, super good and they're an enhanced prisoner, they might get the opportunity to work outside. So in open prisons, usually people can work outside, but there are so many security measures. They have to pass loads of different things before they're allowed to work outside. So I work in a women's prison, closed, and there's lots of a plethora of different situations and different crimes that have been committed. And it's incredibly varied and interesting. So what do I do as a chaplain? Well, as much as I love prayer, I don't just go around praying all day, although I wish I could. There are some things called statutory duties. So a chaplain has to do these statutory duties. Statutory duties are like a legal requirement. It's a process that processes that have to happen in the prison. You can't not do them. So if I go in, I have to do these stats or I'd be in serious trouble. So the statutory duties make up a huge part of chaplaincy, and I'm going to tell you a bit about them. So one statutory duty is that we have to see every single person, it doesn't matter what their faith is, we have to see every single person who comes into the prison. So we call them new inductions. So in their first 24 hours of prison, they're in quite a lot of, there's a lot of risk because it's quite traumatic going into prison. They've got higher risk of suicide or self-harm. It can be, well, you can imagine, can't you? So, you know, overnight it could be that that person's life's completely changed and now they're in prison and they're flustered. They don't know, you know, they're scared because they've only seen what prisons are like on these Hollywood films and they don't know what to expect. So one of the duties as a chaplain is for me to go in and speak to them. And what a privilege that is because, you know, in the most lovely way I've been crying with prisoners, you know, because my heart goes out to them, especially when they've lost, you know, members of their family, or say there's been a car accident or something, and they're at fault, and maybe they've been responsible for somebody dying. You know, it can be really quite hard for people. So I get this privilege of going in and saying, "Hi, I'm Sammy. I'm a chaplain here," you know, and I tell them a bit about the rules of the prison. I give them a leaflet on chaplaincy. I check their religious registration to see, you know, whether they're Christian or Muslim, and then they can be invited to the relevant services that take part place in the jail. And I also obviously comfort them and listen to a bit of their story. And often I get the absolute privilege of praying with them. And often chaplaincy really is a ministry of presence. So it's sometimes there's absolutely nothing I can say or do to help them. The only thing I can do is just be there and often let them know that God's there too, even if they don't realise it. So that's amazing. Some of the other statutory duties, so that's the induction. We see everybody who's about to leave, because that can be quite traumatic as well. If you've done a long sentence, so you've done a 12-year sentence, and you might have become a little bit institutionalised, and then coming out of prison can be, you know, perhaps you're nervous of whether you're going to get housing, you know, what jobs are you going to be able to get, you know, if you haven't got family support, there's all those things to consider. So often girls in my prison want prayer. And also practical help, like I might refer them to organisations like the Nelson Trust, who help with resettlement, and there's also a resettlement department in the prison, so I might make sure that resettlement have spoken to them and try to sort out any housing issues and things like that. Some other statutory duties, and this is probably one of the ones that I find the most difficult as a chaplain. And I was saying to Alex this morning, I had something like 3 on Friday. Unfortunately, chaplains have to notify prisoners when somebody's passed away. So we could get a phone call, say, from their mum saying maybe their dad's passed away. And so a chaplain has to get that confirmed. So I need to ring around police station or coroners or funeral directors, whatever's more relevant. And then I'd have to go and tell the prisoner that that person's passed away. So that's probably my least favourite thing to do. As much as it's a privilege, it's really hard. It's incredibly hard. And often you don't get the reaction that you think you're going to get. So it could be that I told one girl that somebody had passed away, and she just threw herself around the room screaming, you know, and I was like, oh, wow, Lord, help me, what can I, you know, and I just had to, again, ministry of presence, just be there, and so she knows that I care, you know, and obviously we do follow-up visits, we do candle lighting, so a lot of prisoners want to be collected from their cells and taken to chapel, because we have a little chapel within the prison, and we've got wings, if you like. They're called wings or reses, we call them, where you've got the prisoners' cells, pretty much opposite chapel. We've got three wings in Eastwood Park. So I can just literally open a door. Well, you have to unlock everything because you have keys and a radio. And I have to unlock the door, pop across the corridor, and then I've got three wings of girls who are locked up. And so often I'll, you know, unlock them and then bring them over to chapel. We might say some prayers, light a candle. As a chaplain, like I said, you can see any faith. But for me, because I'm classed as a free church chaplain, I run the free church services. So I do one service a month in Eastwood Park. And then all the girls who identify as a Christian, they can come along and take part in worship. If somebody's just inquiring and they're not registered as a Christian, they can come along too for a certain amount of sessions to see whether they want to, you know, want to know more. We run introduction to Christianity courses. There's lots of information that we give out, Christian literature, books. And a huge part of our day is pastorals. So that would be me going to a cell and just saying, you know, is everything okay? And just, again, just being there, offering prayer. And prayer is one of my favourite things. I've been on a wing before and I've been talking to somebody who say they're crying, they're upset about something, maybe they're missing a loved one. And I've got, and I always say, would you like prayer? I don't tend to ask them what their faith is. I just say, would you like prayer? And often they'll say, and they call everybody miss. So they go, yes, miss, yes, miss. And so I might pray with them. And it might be through a little hatch if I can't unlock them. So it might be through a little hatch and I'm saying a prayer. And then other girls can hear me praying. And they're, amen, miss, amen. Can you come pray for me? And they go, yeah, no problem. And then you're just going from door to door praying. And honestly, oh, it's absolutely lush. It's brilliant. I love that part of the job. It's amazing. So, yeah, we do Bible studies. And the other thing, a statutory duty, is seeing everybody who has been segregated from the rest of the prison. Now, usually prisons have a segregation unit. So everybody who's perhaps a danger to themselves or a danger to others have to be segregated. Because a lot of prisoners share cells. You know, there's usually two in a cell. But when they're in segregation, they have to be moved to a single cell and put in segregation. But in Eastwood Park, there isn't a segregation. So what happens is they just get moved to a single cell and they get locked in. But when somebody is a harm to other people or themselves, there is a legal responsibility for the governor to see them every day, for somebody from healthcare to see them, mental health, and a chaplain. So the thing that makes Eastwood Park quite exceptional compared to perhaps other prisons is that we have, in all women's estates, there is it's a horrible statistic, but women's estates, they usually have a huge level of self-harm. And so compared to, say, you might go to another prison, there might be 10 a week people self-harming. In Layhill, there was one in the whole prison who self-harmed. In Eastwood Park, it's about 60 a week. So prison chaplains have to go and see them, and we have to document, we have to have a meaningful conversation. So a meaningful conversation, what does that look like? A meaningful conversation would be something like trying to engage with people who perhaps don't want to be engaged with. So I'll give you an example of how I do this. It might be that you've got somebody in a cell and say they're just pacing like this. I knock on the door. Hiya, I'm Sammy, the chaplain. How you doing? And they're just, you know, doing this, ignoring me. So I've got to think, like, how am I going to have a meaningful conversation with someone who doesn't want a conversation? So I start looking around their room through the hatch. And I start thinking, all right, they've got a little picture there. Maybe I can focus on that picture. So I might say, oh, I notice you've got a picture up there. Who's that of then? You know, anything to try and draw them into. Or I might say, oh, I notice you're a bit agitated. You know, has something wound you up? How are you feeling? You know, anything to try and get them to interact. And then usually, if you don't give up and you persevere, usually they'll speak to you. And it's the same with people. I mean, within reason, there are people that we visit who are very unwell, mentally unwell, and it doesn't prove purposeful to push it, because actually it could just trigger them, you know, and they might become a bit more psychotic. Or so you have to kind of weigh it up. But it is a statutory duty to have that meaningful conversation. And a meaningful conversation, I think, as well, is sitting with those people's feelings. It's not necessarily trying to fix anything, which I found quite hard initially, because I do like to fix things. I had to realise that the whole task is being present. It's not necessarily fixing, because some things just, they can't be fixed. So it's engaging with somebody, caring, knowing that you've got God present with you as well, and then interacting with them, trying to point out things that you could talk about, and then usually reflecting their feelings back to them. So that's a good way of being present. So, for example, if someone's seeming agitated, I might say, oh, you seem quite agitated. Is everything okay? And they might go, no, it's not. I'm really upset. And I go, so I start reflecting with them. I go, oh, right, okay. So you're feeling upset. Well, you know, what's happening for you? And it's just, again, you know, it's not quite counselling, but it's the kind of, I suppose, the stage one of counselling, where you're just doing that reflection and you're sitting in the pit of despair with them. So you're getting down into the pit and you're going, right, I'm here and I'm going to share this experience with you. Then, if you can, you might say words of encouragement to help them help themselves out of the pit. Do you see, on an emotional level, certainly. But it really depends on what their situation is. It might be that just being present, offering prayer, is more than enough. Right, what else? So Sunday services, yep, are a bit like this. We don't always have technology. Sometimes I just have a CD player. I have done a service on the actual wings before. Because sometimes what happens, which is quite frustrating, if the staff are under a certain amount, say, for instance, they're supposed to have 100 staff and only 80 turn up because of sickness or COVID, it means that certain provisions get cancelled. So there's been times where I've prepared for a service and it's been cancelled. So, and I probably won't do it again. I've only done this twice. I went to every wing and did a service on each wing. Now, there's 10 wings. I couldn't do 10, so I had to try and think, right, I'll do the biggest ones. So I managed to do 4 in a row, which was incredibly exhausting, you can imagine. But I, you know, I felt compelled to do it, so I would go ahead and do it. But I wouldn't advise it. Usually, on a Sunday, I have to do 2 services back to back, because you can't fit everybody in church. There's too many prisoners. There's probably about 200 plus Christians in the actual jail. They won't all come to church, though. So you might only get, say, 50, 60 come to church, but they've got to be split. So I'll do a service like this. I'll have like 10, 5-minute break, quick cup of tea, pop to the toilet, and then I'll do the service all over again. Then after service, I'll do the statutory duties. So I might need to see 15 people or something like that straight after. So it's very, very busy role. It's absolutely exhausting, but in the most beautiful way. So it's brilliant. So I'm going to go straight into telling you a story. So I've told you a bit about prison chaplaincy. If after the service, when we have tea and coffee, you've got any questions about prisons, or this might have been things I've forgotten to tell you, but please come up and speak to me. And, you know, it's my favourite subject other than Jesus, do you know what I mean? So please come up to me and I'll talk all day about it and bore the pants off you. However, there is a story I want to tell you that I think this is what God's really put on my heart for today. And it's a story about when I worked in a prison before I became a chaplain. So, and I think it's something to do with persistence. And I think he's wanting me to share something with you to do with that. So I'm going to tell you a story now. And I'm going to try not to cry because it's a really emotional story for me. So before I became a prison chaplain, I didn't know that's where God was leading me. I knew he wanted me to be in ministry. And I was doing a bit of preaching. I did the Pathways course. But like I said, I jumped from job to job. I just wasn't really that satisfied with anything. And I finally got a job in a Presbyterian church, in a community centre attached to a Presbyterian church. And that went so wrong. It was an absolute disaster. And so I was frantically, you know, I couldn't understand why it went so wrong. Within 6 months, you know, I think everybody hated me there. I didn't fit in at all. You know, I don't know, beige enough. Who knows? But, you know, I didn't fit and that was that. So I started looking on the computer for another job. And I found a job in a prison. And I remembered years and years ago, this is before I was even a Christian, I had an interest in working in prisons because I'd done a psychology degree years ago. And I remember thinking it'd be quite nice to work in a prison, maybe as a forensic psychologist or something like that. And I'd kind of forgotten all about that. And so I started looking at prisons, and there was a job as a wellbeing coordinator. And a wellbeing coordinator pretty much does the same as a chaplain without any of the religious stuff. So, yeah, I applied for it, and I got that job. And that was in a different prison, completely different prison. And I thought it was the best job in the world. And I met some great prisoners there. And I want to tell you a story about one prisoner. Now, I've changed his name and changed a few details for confidentiality. But I want to tell you about this guy because it's relevant. This guy had, I think he murdered somebody when he was 13. And he was a prolific self-harmer. And he didn't joke about it either. He, you know, he had a cut straight across here. And he used to starve himself. And he had loads of cuts. And he was painfully thin. And he was very smart. And I got introduced to him when I was a wellbeing coordinator. He wouldn't engage with anyone. And he was difficult. So they asked me as a last kind of... last thing for help, see if Sammy can go in and do something with him. So knocked on his door, on his cell door. He didn't want to know. He was like, go away. You're all the same. None of you really care. Not interested. And I said, well, you know, I'm not going anywhere, mate. It's not happening. I'm gonna just pester you until you speak to me. You know, and this is the thing, I used my own personality. I didn't try and be someone else. I was myself. And eventually he broke and he started speaking to me. But he would still be pushing me away. He'd say things like this: who are you to tell me that I should live? Because that's just transference. I've got every right to want to die. And you have not got the right to tell me that I should live. So these are the kind of conversations I would have with him. And that you can imagine, that was pretty challenging. So even though it wasn't a religious role at that point, I had to tell him that I believed in God and that I believed God loved him. And I said, look, I'm not trying to force you to believe in God or anything, but, you know, I'm here because God wants me here. And I'm here because I believe your life is worth something, even if you don't. And I just want to get to know you better. Will you let me just get to know you better? And so I started playing cards with him once a week, rummy. And of course, we didn't play much cards, really. That was just a conduit to strike up conversation. So we'd be playing cards, not really, and just talking. And he told me this amazing story. Oh, man, So when he was a kid, he was in care with his sister, and unfortunately, he was being abused. And before he got taken into care, his birth mum said to him, "If you're ever scared, go to a graveyard." It's an odd thing to say, isn't it? "Go to a graveyard, because nobody will look for you in a graveyard." Right? So he's being abused, he's in care, he's scared, so he goes to the nearest graveyard. And he sits on a bench opposite a bunch of graves. And that morning, a minister, a church minister, is washing the dishes, and his wife died a few years ago, and he hadn't visited her grave for a while. And he looked out the window, and there was a robin on the edge of the window, you know, on the windowsill. And her favourite birds were robins, right? So he's washing up, and he thinks, "I think I'm going to go visit the grave." He felt a bit bad, and he thought, "I'm going to go see her grave." And her grave was directly opposite the bench that young kid was sat on. And so he sits next. He notices the kid looks a bit upset. So he sits next to the kid, and it transpires. He starts telling him that he's being abused. And this church minister informs the police, and him, you know, the kid and the sister get taken away from this family who are abusing them. Amazing story. So that's the background of this story and this guy. Now, I worked in this job as a wellbeing coordinator for about 18 months. And then I got told that the contract is going to end. And I'll be honest with you, I cried for about a month. Every day, I was so... Sometimes you didn't even hear me cry, babe. I was so upset. I was so upset. I could not believe, and angry. I couldn't believe God had given me, finally, my dream job. And I was doing so much good, and I was praying with people, even maybe when I shouldn't have been. But, you know, I couldn't understand why he was going to take it away from me. Why was he going to take it away from me? So then, the beginning of COVID, hadn't been in for a few months, and it was my final day. And I went to see that guy. Now, I'm going to call him Rob. That's not his name. But I went to see Rob, and he was in the healthcare section of the prison. And that morning, when I woke up, I was thinking of the Footprints poem. I don't know why. It just came in my head. I started thinking of the Footprints poem. Anyway, I go into the jail. I'm sad. And I think, I've got to go say goodbye. And I thought, how am I going to say goodbye without absolutely crying my eyes out? I don't know how I'm going to do it. So I turn up to his cell, and I actually get the officer to unlock his cell. And I've got a little chair, and he's got a little chair. And I said, look, I've come to say goodbye. It just makes me so upset even thinking of it. Sorry. So I said, I've got to say goodbye. And he was so upset that I was going, and I couldn't understand why God was going to take me away. And I thought, who's going to look after him? He won't engage with anyone. Like, who has God got somebody in tow? Because, you know, this guy, nobody cares. They've given up on him. So anyway, we're talking, and I said, look, Rob, can I pray for you? I thought, you know, it's my last day. What are they going to do? Sack me? It's my last day. Can I pray with you? And he said, yeah. But when the cell door was open, I noticed he'd blacked the whole room out. He'd managed to get some kind of blacked out sheet, and he put it over his window. And it just looked so depressing, honestly. Like, And he was in a bad state. And so I said, can I pray for you? And he said, yeah, of course you can. And I prayed that a robin would come and visit him, and that he would look out of his window and see a robin, and that would give him comfort. And I know it's a bit of a weird prayer, but because of what he told me, that special story he told me, I just knew God was going to do it. And he looked at me and he said, if you pray for a robin, I'll have to let the light in. And I said, yeah, you will have to let the light in. And of course, I meant that on a whole other level. It's not just letting the light physically in. It's like letting God in. And sometimes I think when we're going through difficulty, when things don't work out the way we want them to, we can block the light a little bit, can't we? Because I don't know about you, but I thought I was so angry with God when he took that job away. You know, I didn't feel like worshipping him. I didn't feel like loving him or trusting him. I felt angry. And I think sometimes this Rob felt like that, because it was very unlikely he was never going to get out of prison. And he'd given up. But he said, okay, pray for the robin. Pray for the robin to come see me. And I said, that's lovely. And just as I was about to go, he said, Sam, have you heard of the Footprints poem? And I said, funny you say that, Rob. Yeah, I have. And he said, is there any chance you could get that printed off for me before you go? And I said, yeah. So I went all the way round to the other side of the wing, and there was this officer who wouldn't have heard any of this, right, on the computer. And some of the officers are lovely, some of them, they're a bit hardened, you know, to prisoners, so they may not be the most sympathetic individuals. Not all prison officers are like that, but some are. And so he's on the computer, and I say, oh, excuse me, would you mind, do you know the Footprints poem? Have you ever heard of it? It's a bit twee, but, you know, have you heard of it? He said, it is not twee. And, you know, he got all defensive. He said, I had that poem read at my grandparents' funeral. And I said, oh, really? He said, in fact, and he rolled up his leg like this, and he had a tattoo of the footprints with a line from the Footprints poem. And I thought to myself, oh, Lord, you have got a plan. There is somebody who cares. Thank you so much. So he printed off the Footprints poem and I gave it to Rob. And then I left prison. And I suppose what I'm getting at here is that often when things don't go our way or expectations aren't met, we can feel like shutting the light out. We can feel like turning our backs on God. We can feel like not worshipping him, feeling hopeless. And our trust can, you know, we can waver a bit. But, you know, I pray today that if anybody here is going through a time of uncertainty and they feel like, you know, giving up, they're losing hope in some way, I pray that you still let the light in. Keep letting the light in, because God's got a plan. He had a plan for that lad, Rob, and he had a plan for me, because after about, I think it was about a year or so later, He moved me into chaplaincy. So if I hadn't have left that job that made me losing it, cry for a month, I wouldn't have been a chaplain now. And obviously he knew that. I didn't know that. So let the light in, which means don't give up on God. Persevere. God's already paved a way. And don't give up. Amen.